Blog Talk Radio.
Centuries of people being systematically and forcibly indoctrinated by Christian teachings, Christianity is nothing but a tool to remove spiritual knowledge, and it's to disarm us so that we cannot see certain things. It's like trying to fight a war with part of your senses gone, not being able to see or sense the enemy. But there's a lot of we are only operating on a very small portion, like using 5 to 10% of our brain, because Christianity has prevented us from exploring our brains and our souls and the powers of our minds any further. Because in the Christian Bible, it's constant threats like burning in hell, a witch suffer, a witch to burn, all that garbage and that trash they throw at us to disarm us. And the Jews just use this liberally at the top, black magic and such, Jewish ritual sacrifice, of which they kidnap a Gentile child around Passover and take them into the back of the synagogue secretly and nail them to a cross or secure them to a cross in some way, and then they slash their throat or they make them bleed to death kosher style. And what this does is it sets up a powerful subliminal connection to Christianity and that Nazarene on the cross. And note that in the Judeo-Christian Bible, on just about every page of the Judeo-Christian Bible, the word Jew, Jews, and or Israel is used. So the entire book is pretty much totally about the Jews, Jewish patriarchs, Jewish everything. Abraham, everything was stolen. Abraham is an anagram of Brahma. That was stolen, and because the subliminal connections, people miss the subliminal connections because they're not trained to look for it. They're trained to disregard it as bunk and junk and like it doesn't exist. But just because someone doesn't believe in something, that doesn't mean that it doesn't exist. The extent that the Christian Bible is just pushed on everybody, it is pushed, whether you want it or not. Today's December 25th, and I noted, just walking in a supermarket with the Christmas carols blasting over the speakers, walking up and down the aisles, they always have the music blaring away. This people do not realize just how embedded the Judeo-Christian Bible is in everything. I was forced, like many other people, to attend church. I was raised Catholic, forcibly raised Catholic, when I was a child, and I had to go to church every Sunday whether I wanted to or not. And when my mother didn't accompany me to church, she made sure that I went. And a lot of people are in the same boat. You don't have a choice. So just right there about that free will garbage, that's a lie, another Christian lie. And you will find that many Christians are prolific liars, just like the Jews, because Christianity itself is a lie. But these Christmas carols that I was talking about, I can remember word per word. It's like they'll ring in your head. You know, like where you have a song going on in your head that you just rather forget, and it just keeps going on, annoying. And these lyrics, it's like you know them by heart. And to make matters worse, children are hauled off to Sunday school and even beaten if they don't memorize Bible verses correctly. And there is nothing spiritual at all about the Judeo-Christian Bible. It is a book, it is a subliminal, it's like a seed pod. And I know, you know, it sounds jokingly, but there's a movie made in 1956, a sci-fi movie, Invasion of the Body Snatchers, where they use these seed pods to turn these people into like walking zombies where there's no emotion, just nothing, you know, like a pasty Christian smile where they force, well, you don't have a choice, type of deal. And those seed pods actually, I mean, they correlate very well with Bibles. I read a book, there's a book out, and I don't know the technical name for this, but I do know it has to do with subliminal learning, and it was a new method, but there were certain people who could just place their hands on any book in a trance state, and they could absorb all of the knowledge in that book. Now, knowing about that, there's a lot of things that we absorb subconsciously that we aren't even aware of. But our subconscious mind is, and it's embedded in the soul. And we're taught to ignore this aspect of our lives, especially under the Judeo-Christian yoke. They got rid of all that, and it's a stepping off point to communism. And it's a preparation for communism. Because within communism, there is no spirituality. I mean, you are not allowed anything spiritual, but yet they still have a lot of Judeo-Christian churches, like in China, even today, and in the former Soviet Union, and different countries that were behind the Iron Curtain before the fall of the Iron Curtain in communism in the early 90s. They don't have anything. They'll pretend to be persecuted by it. Oh, communism doesn't allow Christianity, they persecute Christians and all this garbage. That isn't true. Try being a pagan or a Satanist. You're going to see what real persecution is. Like the Falun Gong practitioners, Falun Gong is like Tai Chi in a way, and it amplified the spirit in the way that internal martial arts does over in China, and they tortured these people to death. The communist government did not tolerate that for 5 minutes. I mean, it's like they went after these people. And I also would like to mention here, too, that the Jews, they're in charge of all the communism. And you find even Chinese Jews way up the ladder running at the government and in positions, key positions of power. And they got rid of these Falun Gong practitioners, and what they do with a lot of the slave labor they have, the same thing in China. And I'm going to expose all this as I go along here. The Bible is a preparation for slavery, but they even sell their body parts on the black market. There's a movie, 1978, Coma. It's an older movie, but it's pretty revealing concerning how the black market, they trade body organs for people who need organ transplants, and they charge hundreds of thousands of dollars the Jew makes off of this. So it's like they just fleece people down to where they don't even, their organs aren't even their own anymore. They take everything. But I also want to add, the Judeo-Christian Bible, it's you walk into, a hotel room, it's a transmitter. It's a subliminal transmitter, and when it's like money, and everybody has money. I mean, currency, we handle currency, just about everybody. And I know there's people that are destitute totally, and I feel bad. It's horrible. But the average person in average country, even in the poorer countries, handles currency on a daily basis. And when I went into those Twin Towers, and how they were, you could fold a $20 bill and it would show them going up in smoke. And there's another one, you flip side the Pentagon, and there's even another one now with the new $100 bill that shows New York is going to come under attack at some point. And I believe that might be in another 5 years astrologically, but I don't know for sure. I haven't done enough research on it where there's going to be like a major crisis, only this is going to be worse than the Twin Towers, and the $100 bill is even bigger. But my point being is you handle money every day, and it's subliminal. I mean, it's in your mind, and also the Bible is put everywhere. It's in hospitals, hotel rooms, they push it. And the Christians who tie into this energy that are heavily Christian, I mean, you've got different degrees of Christianity. You've got people that call themselves Christians, and they aren't even Christians. I mean, they call themselves Christians, classify themselves. And then you've got these others that are a little stronger in it, and they push it relentlessly, like they did with the Inquisition. And the Inquisition and communism are identical. It's the same thing. People, it's either you get tortured to death. They even prosecuted descendants of what they called witches that went back to great-grandparents. They prosecuted the descendants, took all their money, everything they had, their land, what little they had. And the Catholic Church ruled over like a theocracy of serfdom. It's the same thing as communism. And I also want to add that Stalin, Jewish Joseph Stalin, his real name was Joseph Dugashvili. Son of a Jew. Dugashvili means son of a Jew in Georgian. That five-year plan and everything, you'll hear a lot of Jews defending that, making excuses for it and everything. Well, these purges had to be done, yadda yadda, as long as it doesn't happen to them in mass. A few of them got it over there, though. But the point being, when they start going after the higher-up Jews, and that's when they start getting into problems like that doctor's plot and Stalin, they just let him die. I mean, I guess it was 15 hours or something. He was laying in a room after he had a stroke, and they just let him die in there because of that doctor's plot. But that five-year plan that they're always talking about, truth be known, after the Second World War, the Soviet Union is always backward, and they're not looking, they weren't looking to advance in any way. Is a slave labor state. All the communist countries are a slave labor for the Jew. And the five-year plan didn't get them any further ahead. The technology that the Soviet Union obtained, and most of it was after the Second World War, was taken from top Nazi scientists that they kidnapped and they forcibly made to work in the Soviet Union after the fall of Berlin. Germany in the Second World War, and also the United States, the same thing. They kidnapped German scientists, and they brought them over here, and they forced them to give up their secrets and to work on certain military projects. It had nothing to do with the slave labor. That was just slave labor over there. And they never really advanced. The Soviet Union was one of the most dreary, drab, hellish place. I mean, and I'm saying that in a way like just horrid. I mean, hell isn't a bad place. I'm talking about what we call where Satan's at, okay? I'm talking, when I say hellish, I mean just horrid, okay? I'm using it in that context. Places on earth. And I wouldn't even want to visit over there. They never progressed. People, if you watch the movie Moscow on the Hudson with Robin Williams, it's pretty revealing about how people lived in Soviet Union, waiting for in lines 3 blocks long for a roll of toilet paper. That's what they were reduced to. And those are the ones that live in the cities. And they didn't, the slave labor that they called and took to Siberia, they worked these people to death. And I've already made a audio sermon about that, and I'll be making some more. They've done the same thing in China, famine, same thing, forced famine. I also want to add Tibet. I'm going to do an audio sermon on what happened to Tibet. The Tibetan people, the Buddhists there, they're very, very peaceful people. They don't bother anybody. They're peace-loving. The Chinese army marched in there and just slaughtered them. Same thing, famine tortured their monks, and these people are very peace-loving people, and they're non-violent. And all communism is they come in there and they just torture people to death like the Inquisition, enslave everybody. But getting back to this subliminal deal, this Judeo-Christian Bible, every action, everything that you see here, you're probably sitting here, you're listening to this audio sermon. You could get it from a friend maybe on a CD or something. But the point being is everything you have in front of you, including the chair you're sitting in, the bed you're lying on, was someone's idea before it manifested into reality. Even the words I'm speaking now, I mean, I have an idea in my mind, the sermon that I'm giving here, you know, the gist of it, the focus of it, before I give the sermon. Every action, even like if you're hitting a punching bag or something, it proceeds in the mind before you do it in reality. And what Christianity does is it sets entire nations up for slavery and to accept communism. And I also noticed that, like in the right wing, like National Socialists and related right-wing patriotic groups that focus on their race, our race is our nation, and that's the Orion, O-R-I-O-N, our race is our nation, and that's what Satan is fighting for, is individuality, culture, differences. Okay. Christianity is used as a tool to destroy these groups. And I've also seen where there's a lot of National Socialist writings where they claim Adolf Hitler was a Christian. Nothing could be further from the truth. Adolf Hitler was a Satanist. The entire Third Reich, the top, they were Satanists. And I'm not just saying this, this is a fact. And if you look at their symbols and everything that they did, and they were working to destroy Christianity, but after the war, and even before the war, translations, like Mein Kampf, for instance, the 1938 copy, and after that, was so mistranslated in the sense that they embedded Christian sayings in there that Adolf Hitler never said or never wrote. And they also made it unreadable, very dry. And there's ways they do that. The Jews do that. And also mistranslations, even in Heinrich Himmler's writings, some of his writings, he said the word evil in German, and they translated it in English into satanic. So you see what I'm saying there. They know they were Satanists. So they're going to use Christianity as a tool, and there's a lot of traitors, extreme traitors, that are embedded, like in National Socialist organizations and that. And some of these are also at the Soul, and I have an old copy of a book here, and it's available on PDF on the internet, and the Christian filth that was embedded in there in the PDF copy is not in the original copy. Dr. Madeline Murray O'Hare of American Atheists, she was a really good woman. She fought Christianity, and she was highly intelligent, and she fought Christianity to the day she died. She was murdered by a Christian. She showed different texts and how the Christians, or Jews, or whatever, because the Jews use Christianity, though they pretend to be enemies with Christianity, which they're not. They take control of both sides, and they work it to their Jewish communist agenda of taking over the world. And everything the Jew is, everything they are, and everything they do, they blame on their enemies. They say Adolf Hitler wanted to take over the world. That isn't true. That's a lie. Communists, they want to take over the world, and they will, just what happened in Tibet. Do a little research, and I'm also going to be giving more sermons on this. But Madeline Murray O'Hare discovered certain texts where Christians put Christian statements in there, like one was from Benjamin Franklin, and it didn't even look like it belonged in there, saying that America was a Christian nation and all this garbage and stuff about Christianity, and it was not in the original. And that's why Satan tells us in the El Jilwa, he said that the texts are altered. He says, memorize, and he says, I lead to the straight path without a book. Because the enemy has always been rewriting history and filling it with their garbage and putting their Christian crap in it, and targets of choice are like right-wing National Socialist groups, because they're onto the Jews. So what they're going to do is they're going to try to get in there. They know they can't with communism, because they're onto their Jewish communism, so they push Christianity into these groups. And what it does is they get control of it again. So if they don't attack a group that's onto the Jews, an organization that's onto the Jews, they rot things out by the inside. They get in, like Rothschild did. He got into Freemasonry a long time ago, and it was a Luciferian organization, and he got in there, and he changed the teachings and geared it towards Christianity and rotted it out from the inside. And there's a book out, I think it's by James Shaw, and I have it listed, Freemasonry. And this poor man, I'm just sad, he went to the top, the 33rd degree Mason, which actually 33 degrees of the spine is supposed to be the Kundalini serpent, esoteric degrees of the spine, the risen serpent, to be a 33rd degree Mason. But these days that's not the case. When they hit the 33rd degree, they're taken to one of the way high temples or some darn thing, and they're they're geared towards communism. So that's what the Jew does. The Jew gets into all of our Gentile organizations, either through kissing ass. And I also want to mention, I've seen posts in some of the e-groups. The sermon's starting to get a little long here, and I should hang this up, where people, stupid people, say that the Jews are dumb, they're stupid. Oh, I don't think so. The average Jew has an IQ of 135 and up. They are not stupid. A lot of them are very talented. They're sneaking and conniving, and they use their intelligence for very nefarious purposes, and they're prolific liars. And that's how they get in. That's how they get inside. Most of them, I'm talking about the higher-ups, and they take control, and then they gear it towards the destruction of Gentile peoples and their enslavement, and they gear it towards their Jewish world goal of communism. They're the ones that want to take over the entire world. But my point being is, even crossword puzzles, I like to do puzzles sometimes, like late at night, you know, just word puzzles before I go to sleep. And they got every, you know, anybody get these books, they have to, and most, I want to also reiterate that most of these crossword puzzles are written by Jews. The Jews control 96% of all the media, which is television, the movie industry, all of the books and everything, and they're trying to get control of the internet, which they're having trouble because nobody owns the internet, thanks Satan. And like I said, www translates into vow, vow, vow in Hebrew, and that's 666. And we all know 666 is of Satan, and that's the internet. And through mass communication, I'm hoping this time they can be defeated, because if they don't, all of us are going to be enslaved and gone. This is our last chance. And the only thing you can do is to spread the word. Wake people up. Wake up these sleeping sheep out there. Just work every day to destroy Christianity. But I was getting back to these crossword puzzles. It's always got like Bible crosswords, or Jews. These are Jews that write these. I can tell because they have certain telltale signs, like like a clue, Jewish month, you know, and Jewish different Jewish things that only a Jew would know, or somebody that's educated as to Judaism, you know, their so-called religion. And then they throw the Christian garbage in there, these Bible quotes, like you're supposed to know this stuff. And this is just embedded in everybody. So like I was talking about the $20 bill, the $100 bill earlier, how everybody uses that. I mean, this is systematically embedded in everybody. I mean, how many of you have been forcibly sent to church? I mean, even some of you now, it can't help it, you know, that are underage and just forced to go to church. These verses, these teachings, and it's all about it's just, there's nothing spiritual about it, but they're just embedded in your mind, to where I could walk down the aisle of a supermarket and it could be instrumental without lyrics, the music, and it's like you can remember those lyrics, like the first Noel, born is the King of Israel, and everything is geared towards that second coming of Jesus Christ, which Jesus Christ is a fictitious entity, but it's a powerful thought form. And in addition to that, there are enemy aliens out there, which I would strongly recommend that you listen to all of the audio sermons and view all these there are also video sermons on this YouTube website. Okay, this YouTube website, and the link is here. Because they all come together. Okay, I'm not going to repeat when my high priest just went through a YouTube sermon on there about how the enemy aliens, the Greys and the reptilians, control Christianity from out there. And also certain people tie into Christian energy, and, you know, then sporadic here and there a miracle might happen, but it's false in the sense that they're tying into this energy, and it's like they don't even know what they're doing. And every now and then the enemy from out there will try to make a miracle happen or something for show, to suck more idiots in. And these people, they don't think. They do what they're told to do, but people need to really wake up, because this is very, very serious. And it's a subliminal thing, and it's implanted in most people. That's why Christians, as I was saying earlier, those who are more so into stronger in Christianity, they're tie into energy where they push Christianity on everybody. It's pushed, whether you want it or not. It's like those seed pods and Invasion of the Body Snatchers, 1956 sci-fi movie. They're pushed. You don't have a free will. The Inquisition proves that. And in order to find out whether something is good or evil, you have to give it power. And Christianity was at the height of its power during the Middle Ages, also known as the Dark Ages. And it's the same type of deal as communism. There's just serfdom. Nobody owns anything. They're just a number, and they're just slave labor. It's pretty much the same thing in the Middle Ages. There's no advancement, just stagnation, and the Jews were feeding off of this. But it's very important to get this word out. And these audio sermons, video sermons, they're freely available for everybody. Just get it out, get it, especially in these countries like Russia. Russia is in extreme danger because this Vladimir Putin is a Jew, and he's working with the Jewish community to institute communism over there again. And centuries of Orthodox Christianity prepared the Russian people to accept communism. And there's certain areas, you see the energies are strong over there. Now there's certain areas in Europe. Germany has always been a hotbed of paganism. And paganism, Satanism as they call, is like a catch-all term for paganism, Gentile paganism. And pagan means Gentile. And they had their witches' sabbats and in the Harz Mountains. I mean, Germany's had a long satanic history. And that's why National Socialism thrived in Germany. And they also tore down the Berlin Wall, and that was the beginning of the end of communism. And because communism thrived in Russia, the energies are still there, and the damn Jews are working to institute it again over there. And they're also trying here in America. When the Soviet Union fell in 1991, there was a load of Jews that came to America, cutthroat Jews from the Soviet Union, and they were given the highest paid jobs, college professors, everything over here, and just rolled out the red carpet for them. The Jewish community set them up. I remember, and like I said, we're getting long here, I have to close this. I remember I lived in a suburb up in Minneapolis, and there's across the highway St. Louis Park. St. Louis Park is a very Jewish suburb, analogous, I suppose, to like Brooklyn, New York, Crown Heights or something. I mean, I'm talking about, it's just, everybody knew it was a Jewish suburb of Minneapolis. And I remember one time I went into the video store, and this was long, long time ago, like in the early 90s, 93, 94, right, actually 93, 92, where they had box tapes, the old VHS tapes, to rent. And this video store, Video Update, they had a huge rack, a long one, of nothing but videos that were in Russian. Now that's a dead giveaway as to what they're doing. In Minneapolis, I mean, it's Minneapolis and St. Paul, the Twin Cities, it's a large metropolitan area, probably almost as big as Chicago when you put it all together. But my point being is, what about New York, Los Angeles, and Miami? You think that's bad? And this is kept quiet. People aren't really aware of it. They're not. You know, you have to know what to look for. It's just like the kosher symbols on all of our food products, the K and the U, the little tiny U with a circle around it, Union of Orthodox Rabbis, meaning that food has been blessed and okayed by a rabbi and made as kosher, which they have taken thousands upon thousands upon thousands of dollars from these companies. Of course, they're all Jew-owned anyway, you know, but the point being is you have to pay the extra kosher tax on that when you hit the check out at the supermarket. I'm going to hang this up now, and I'm going to be adding some more sermons here. And also, I want to add, the famine in the Ukraine was just horrific, and it was systematic. They got rid of the middle class. There was a lot of middle class kulaks over there that owned their own land, and they were resistant. They were white. Most of them were of German descent, and this was genocide. And that's one of the reasons Hitler invaded Russia, was to try to help these people. And Adolf Hitler, he was a humanitarian, but the Jews have made him look like a horrible monster, because anybody, just like Satan, Satan means enemy in Hebrew, and it means truth in Sanskrit. Anybody that's against the Jews, or anything that's against the Jews, is automatically slapped and labeled as evil, and then they set up and they say all kinds of lies. They push lies about them. Horrible lies. Slander. But the Ukraine, it's the same thing as Christian garbage. I ran across a YouTube video about the Holodomor. That's what it's called. I'm not sure if I'm pronouncing that correctly, but it's about the famine in the Ukraine. And some stupid Christian idiot is going on and on about how all the churches were full over there, and how all the, you know, and as the famine progressed, the churches, and also the, where they had the forced slave labor, Siberia, where they took people and they just put them on trains and boxcars, bolted them shut for days, weeks at a time into Siberia and used them as slave labor. How the churches disappeared. Well, you know, I just like to think, well, excuse my language here, but just where in the fuck was their God? That God that they so slavishly worshipped in those churches did not lift so much as a finger to help those people out under the most heinous conditions. And this fool, this idiot fool, they whine the loudest. The Christians and the Jews, you know, I'm talking about the Christian, like the priests and all these stupid fools, that got theirs along with the rest of the Gentiles over there, and the slave labor and the famine and such, and the real concentration camps, they whine the loudest. But if they, what good does it do to worship a monster? That is a Jewish God. It is actually, I mean, like I said, God and the devil are backwards. What the Christians call God and the devil. There's no way that freedom or it's a human-hating entity, and it's just after slave labor, and it's a parasite in the sense, like the Greys, they just feed off of the energy of these souls, these Christian souls that are pure, that aren't reincarnated, that go to that so-called pie in the sky. They're called the One. But what good does it do for these people? You'd think that they had some common sense. I mean, not you know, I mean, this is just total idiocy to slavishly worship this monster in their churches. It has nothing to do with spirituality or anything. It's a plague on humanity. And it sets everyone up for communism, and yet they complain when they wind up where they're at. When every day, every week they go to church, they're singing for their own damnation. Like, Noel, Noel, born is the King of Israel. Rejoice, rejoice. The Jewish Messiah, and as it says in the Jewish Talmud, when that Messiah comes, every Jew is going to have 2,800 slaves. And you wonder why we're damned? And I'm telling you, if this isn't turned around and people don't wake up, and there's nothing spiritual about that Bible, and people who have done yoga and meditation for the first time and have felt their souls through Satan can understand what spirituality is. And that Bible, there's nothing spiritual about it. People need to wake up, get the word out, have a big mouth. They shut you down, they take your stuff down, put it right back up. But I'm telling you, you wonder the mentality and why we're where we're at. Praise Israel. It even says that in the Bible. Those who bless the Jews, the Gentiles who bless the Jews, are blessed in return. Well, they're not blessed, actually, in truth, they're damned. Even though, like Billy Graham and his lackeys might get paid quite a bit for leading more sheep to the slaughter. I made this long enough, but wake up, people. Hail Satan. This is a series of sermons that I've been doing on communism. And communism is a stepping off point from Christianity. Christianity prepares people to accept communism. Both are nefarious Jewish programs. Satan wants me to do these sermons and educate people. You won't find most of this information in any schools. You have to seek it out. Most of the schools are controlled by the Jews, Jewish college professors. They've got everything tied up, and they try to promote communism as something positive, which it isn't. It's a horrific Jewish program, and these programs suck people in, and they delude them, same as Christianity. They come in the name of brotherhood and equality, and like a worker's paradise, that type of thing, like they're sticking up for human rights, and nothing could be further from the truth. These Jewish Brotherhood programs, they're all designed to inflict the worst brutality imaginable upon the Gentile populace and turn everyone into slaves, disposable human beings. And as I mentioned before, it's best that you start at the beginning with these sermons, because if you jump in, they all like build on each other. The upper communist echelon, such as the most of the government, the high governmental officials and communist leaders, the majority are Jewish, disproportionately Jewish, or they're married to a Jewess, and they live very well. They have like summer villas and dakas on the Black Sea, and they don't live anything like this. This is the way the average person lives and has lived in the Soviet Union and also in other communist countries. This isn't just specific to the Soviet Union, former Soviet Union. This is very common in all communist countries, the standard of living for people, that the average Gentile person. And this book, the name of this book is Russia and the Russians, Inside the Close Society by Kevin Close. And he and David Satter, who wrote The Age of Delirium, that I read from in my former sermon here, they were journalists in the Soviet Union, and they both worked for the Washington Post. And they, Kevin Close is a Harvard graduate, and a lot of the Russian people, the ones that weren't afraid, because most of them just they lived in the worst terror imaginable from the KGB. Any little thing could get them sent to a gulag, executed, killed, get their entire families killed, anything. They don't dare complain. They live in a total state of terror. And whenever they were aware of an American over there, they would try to, especially a journalist or somebody that's in a position to where they felt that they might be able to help them, the Russians that weren't afraid. Some were courageous, and they sought out American like journalists, and they were telling their stories to try to get this out to the West, what's going on over there. And this was in the late 70s, early 80s, that this Kevin Close and David Satter worked over there, and they stayed in Moscow. And I'm going to read now just how they call us workers' paradise. I don't think so. This is how everybody's equally screwed, and this is how the average person lived over there, and it's horrid. Most American people can't even imagine this. Even people that are living in slums in America, a lot of them don't live this bad. Down a potholed street, hard against a smoking hill of mine waste, so high it blotted out the rising sun until midday, stood the New Colony, a community of three- and four-story walk-ups where many retirees and pensioners from Butovka and other mines lived out the remainder of their lives. We went there one day with Nikitin. After passing through the peeling entranceway of a long, pale cement and stone building, we climbed to the first landing and rapped at one of the two apartment doors. A woman with a strong jaw, high cheekbones, and piercing blue eyes let us in. She was Matryona Ilyichna Leonovna, 67, and she had lived in this apartment for nearly 30 years with her husband, Tikhon Fedorovich Leonov, who was 80. Their home was one room about 14 by 14 feet, with a tiny kitchen off the back and one large window. These people didn't live in a space. There's people that have closets larger than this in America. I mean, this is really, really sad. 14 by 14 feet. A laundry clothesline crisscrossed overhead, greenish wallpaper hung in the corners in ribbons, and the woodwork was gray. Two daybeds stood along the walls. A large table took up the center of the room, and assorted chairs clustered toward the kitchen. The floor was grimy, with a threadbare carpet remnant spread across an uneven hardwood floor. Matryona Ilyichna had worked at Butovka, first as a machinist and then as an attendant in the workers' bathhouse, where she handed out towels and soap. Their son, a bachelor, lived at home with his parents and earned 140 rubles a month. In 1978, he had received an award naming him a victor of Soviet labor for over-fulfilling his norms. Matryona Ilyichna was contemptuous of this, for the award brought nothing more, no extra cash, no promise of a better apartment, or even a can of paint for this one. Since her own pension was 49 rubles a month, money was a serious problem. The family helped make ends meet by renting out space in their one room to a boarder. For many years, a pensioned widow had occupied a spare bed in the room, the best arrangement she could find since her own pension was 37 rubles a month. The widow recently had remarried, however, and now lived nearby with her new but aged husband. The Leonovs were looking for someone else to rent the bed. As we sat talking and taking notes, an ancient bird-like woman dressed in a black padded jacket, woolen stockings and slippers, with a dark shawl pulled around her face, crept into the room of the apartment and leaned against the jamb. When we peeked at her, she pulled her head back just enough so there was no eye contact. But it was easy to see that she was wearing rags. When we worked, there were no private apartments, only communal flats, Matryona Ilyichna said. Now, as pensioners, we don't get what new apartments there are. The workers get them. The ancient at the door nodded slightly. Unexpectedly, another crone in near rags appeared at the door. She was bolder and inched into the room and watched us steadily. She took in the two men with their suits, notepads, pens, and briefcases, and understood immediately. A commission has come, she said to no one in particular. She disappeared, but within moments returned, and now there were four elderly women hovering at the door, listening and murmuring about the commission that somehow had materialized to hear their stories and perhaps do something about the poverty and neglect ruining their final years. Matryona Ilyichna invited the women in, and as they creaked inside, and sat dispiritedly on one of the beds, we learned that the Leonovs had lived in the colony since 1945. But life had moved on, and what was new in 1945 was a slum in 1980. We've been waiting more than 20 years for a better home, but the relatives of the directors and the bosses get any new flats, Matryona Ilyichna said as the aged listeners nodded in agreement, and one of them began weeping. This was life in the fourth largest city of the Ukraine, a Soviet socialist republic with its own voting seat in the United Nations as if it were a nation separate from the USSR. The citizens of the new colony got their water from a community well in a weed-choked field 100 yards from the Leonov's doorway. A journey of about 40 feet in another direction took the residents to their sanitary facilities, six foul-smelling, rough-hewn outhouses. While there is lively and sometimes harsh criticism of housing shortcomings by the official Soviet press as well as warnings of the impact of backyard living conditions on worker morale, those pro forma protestations had little meaning for new colonies' pensioners. In seeking better living conditions, the old people found themselves treated the same way as the rock that must be broken up deep underground to get at the rich seams of coal. They were discarded. With the neighbors paying close attention, Matryona Ilyichna continued her account. They consistently violate the cues. For people who wait for years, it can be agonizing to see themselves passed over year after year until when they are at the head of the queue. But if you complain to some higher authority, they refer it to the lower authorities, and they ignore the complaints or make up any kind of nonsense to explain it. The official union is worthless. Pensioners are always pushed to the back of the queue and ignored. They are on the list from the time when they worked, and they grew up in an era when no apartments at all were available, so they are denied separate apartments in their own old age. Hesitantly, the neighbors began telling their stories. Lydia Yermolaevna Belozorovna had spent many years before and after the war collecting rock at the mine and putting it in piles. In 1953, she found a better job at the Butovka mine. She performed the job of a horse. She was stationed at the bottom of the incline tracks while cars loaded with coal came down the incline, dumped the fuel, and then had to be turned around and sent back up the incline. This was Lydia Yermolaevna's work, and which she did almost without a break during the frantic post-war reconstruction. In all, she said, she had worked 18 years for the Butovka mine and had received an order of the Red Banner for outstanding performance, but no housing, except for the squalor of the new colony. In 1979, she decided that she deserved something better. She took her award and went to see Anatoly Dmitrievich Babich, chief of the mine union, to ask for a one-room apartment of her own. She described how Babich took her award, weighted it in his hands, and then put it back on the desk. "You've received the order of the Red Banner from the state from your work," he intoned. "You aren't going to receive anything more." Another of the women was Olga Grigorievna Famina, 80, a hunchback wisp of a toothless crabapple face. She said she had worked for 16 years as a coal sorter and retired when she was 57. Her monthly pension was 24 rubles, less than half of what was considered the poverty level. "There is no money even for milk. I haven't even seen meat in years," she whispered, peering intently into my face to be sure I comprehended what that meant for her. Earlier that year, she related, she had gone to see one of the senior mine chiefs, a man named Anatoly Fyodorovich Bainba, to ask him for free coal for her cooking and heating. Like most Donetsk residents, Olga Grigorievna could obtain coal from the mines of the former mine worker, but there was a charge of 13 rubles a month, leaving her only 11 rubles on which to live. In the late 1970s, a series of harvest disasters had sent the price of food spiraling upward, and she was desperate. When she walked into the office of the sleek, nachalikt chief, she was immediately buoyed up because she recognized him. In his childhood, he had been a sunny little boy of the neighborhood, doted upon by everyone. She showed him her documents that proved how much she had done for the mine and the motherland. Bainva stared at her as she asked for financial help from the director's discretionary fund, and then he grabbed up the collection of worn papers and threw them on the table. "We don't have money for this. There's nothing in the fund for you." She gathered the pieces of paper. "Dear little son," she remembered telling him, addressing him in the same fond way she had when he was a boy. "My husband was a party member, and when a party man dies, they say at the funeral, 'We are your family and we will never desert you.' And now, dear little son, you're ignoring my appeal for help." Then she got up and walked out of his office. Later that year, friends began giving Olga Grigorievna coal because she was destitute. In August, she had gone to the regional party committee and asked them for help, explaining that she lived in someone else's apartment in the new colony community and though she deserved something better. "Do you have a table?" the official asked her. "I have." "Do you have a bed?" "I have." "That's enough for you. Get out of here." She fainted on the street outside and spent a month recuperating from nervous strain in a city hospital. She never received any help from the mine. She said, and she related this in a subdued voice, tears welled up and rolled down her wrinkled cheeks. As the other women sought to comfort Olga Grigorievna, there was a commotion at the door, and a tough-looking young man with a sodden shapka, fur hat jammed on his head, pushed into the apartment. "What's going on here?" he said, his voice furious and tense. "These are foreign correspondents talking to people, and they are within their rights," Nikitin shouted back. "I know who they are, and they have the right," the intruder said, "but who are you, and what documents do you have?" "Nikitin, Alexei Vasilievich," Nikitin said in the formal official style, "and here are my documents." He held them up. "But who are you and where are your papers?" "I'll get them and I'll be right back," the stranger blustered and walked out. There was stunned silence. With a sardonic smile, Matryona Ilyichna pointed to the window. We could see a bedraggled group of plainclothesmen outside in the windy rain and sleet, stomping their feet and looking angrily at the desolate new colony. Matryona Alyshna tried to get the other pensioners to stay, but the fox had made his appearance. The women filed slowly from the room. They knew the truth. No one was going to help them. And that's just terrible. That's the KGB that was outside watching them, and what happened to some of these people, as you get into the book, it's just horrific. I'm going to wrap this up for now, but that's how the average person in the Soviet Union lived. And as I mentioned before, High Priest Don posted to the E-Group's proof that Vladimir Putin is a Jew. His father was a Talmudic scholar, and he's working with other Jews to try to get Russia back to communism. And this is really serious because they're really working on the United States right now. And a lot of people aren't even aware of it, but if they keep this up and the United States falls to communism, the Jews are going to own all your property. You will have nothing. Your family will have nothing, and more than likely you will wind up in a camp or dead, and so will your family. And this is pretty serious, and most people aren't even aware of it. They're just oblivious to it. And this is Satan wanting me to make these sermons, and I'm going to continue with these to the people that will listen. And hopefully somebody will do something about this under the direction and guidance of Satan. Hail Satan! The following what I'm about to read is rather blatant with the connection of Christianity and communism and how Christianity prepares entire nations for communism. Christianity is also bled into Buddhism. Satan does not demand slavish worship. Satan gives us knowledge and basically the gods of hell, which you call hell, are here to help humanity. Satan stands for liberation, rebellion, and freedom. Satan doesn't expect you to get down and prostrate yourself on the floor and worship him or kneel or anything. Satan has been trying to elevate humanity. This slavish worship crap, this pushed on everybody, you know, this God part of the brain that's exploited in humanity. Servitude is what creates a slave state, and it's necessary. I'm going to be reading here and also note what they're doing in the United States now with the low-watt light bulbs. Ceausescu did it in communist Romania. They couldn't have more than a 40-watt light bulb. 100-watt light bulbs are taken out of circulation, and we're given these little corkscrew light bulbs that actually are bad for your eyesight, so that you can go to an optometrist and get some glasses and then get thicker glasses and pay out the ass to the Jews who put their stocks in glasses. No different than the silver nitrate that they put in the newborn's eyes that they don't even tell you about after you have a baby, and before you know it, when the kid gets to be preteen or adolescent, a large majority of them are nearsighted and they need glasses. It's what the Jew does. This book is called Nothing to Envy, Ordinary Lives in North Korea by Barbara Demick. And this North Korea is still communist, openly communist, no different from Red China. Despite having four children and keeping house, Mrs. Song worked full-time 6 days a week at the Chosun Clothing Factory in Pohang as a clerk in the bookkeeping department of the factory's daycare center. Women were expected to keep the factories going, since North Korea was perpetually short of men. An estimated 20% of working-age men were in the armed services, the largest per capita military in the world. Mrs. Song usually went to work with one baby strapped to her back and one or two others dragging along behind her. Her children basically grew up at the daycare center. She was supposed to work 8 hours with a lunch break and nap in the middle of her shift. After work, she had to spend several more hours in an ideological training in the factory's auditorium. One day, the lecture might be about the struggle against U.S. imperialism. Another time it might be about Kim Il-sung's exploits, actual or exaggerated, fighting the Japanese during World War II. She had to write essays on the latest pronouncements of the Workers' Party or analyze the day's editorials in the Hamburg Ilbo newspaper. By the time she got home, it would be 10:30 p.m. She would do her housework and cooking, then get up before dawn to prepare herself and her family for the day ahead before leaving home at 7 a.m. She seldom slept more than 5 hours. Some days were harder than others. On Wednesday morning, she had to report to work early for mandatory meetings of the Socialist Women's Federation. Friday night, she stayed especially late for self-criticism. In these sessions, members of her work unit, the department to which she was assigned, would stand up and reveal to the group anything they had done wrong. It was the communist version of the Catholic confessional. Mrs. Song would eventually say in all sincerity that she feared she wasn't working hard enough. Mrs. Song believed what she said. All those years of sleep deprivation, all those lectures and self-criticisms, the very same tools used in brainwashing or interrogations, had wiped out any possibility of resistance. Chang Bo had a brush with the law. One night, he and Mrs. Song were home watching the television news with some neighbors. Mrs. Song and her husband were among the few families in their apartment building to own their own television set. In 1989, televisions cost the equivalent of 3 months' salary, about $175, and you weren't allowed to buy one without special permission from your work unit. They were usually bestowed by the government in the name of Kim Il-sung as a reward for extraordinary service. Chang Bo got theirs because his father had been an intelligence officer who had infiltrated the South during the Korean War. The set was manufactured by the Japanese company Hitachi, but had a Korean brand name, Songnamu, meaning pine tree. Televisions and radios in North Korea are preset so that they can receive only official government channels. Still, the programming was relatively entertaining, because besides the usual speeches of Kim Il-sung, on a typical weeknight you might have sports, concerts, television dramas, and movies produced by Kim Jong-il's film studio. On weekends, you might get a Russian movie as a special treat. Mrs. Song and her husband were proud of their television. They usually left the door open to their apartment when it was on so that neighbors could wander in and watch with them. It was in keeping with the collective spirit of the times. The program that got Chang Bo in trouble was an innocuous business report about a shoe factory producing rubber boots for the rainy season. The camera panned over crisply efficient workers on an assembly line where the boots were being produced by the thousands. The narrator raved about the superb quality of the boots and reeled off and the impressive production statistics. "Ha! If there are so many boots, how come my children never got any?" Chang Bo laughed aloud. The words tumbled out of his mouth before he could consider the consequences. Mrs. Song never figured out which neighbor blabbed. Her husband's remark was quickly reported to the head of the Imeminbam, the neighborhood watchdogs, who in turn passed on the information to the Ministry for the Protection of State Security. This ominously named agency is effectively North Korea's police state. It runs an extensive network of informers. By the accounts of defectors, there is at least one informer for every 50 people, even more than East Germany's notorious Stasi, whose files were pried upon after Germany's reunification. Spying on one's countrymen is something of a national pastime. There were the young vigilantes from the Socialist Youth League, like the one who stopped Mrs. Song for not wearing a badge. They also made sure people weren't violating the dress code by wearing blue jeans or t-shirts with Roman writing, considered a capitalist indulgence, or wearing their hair too long. The party issued regular edicts saying that men shouldn't allow the hair on top of their head to grow longer than 5 centimeters, though an exemption was granted for balding men, who were permitted 7 centimeters. If violation was severe, an offender could be arrested by the public standards police. There were also Kyuchi Alde, mobile police units who roamed the streets looking for offenders and had the right to barge into people's houses without notice. They would look for people who use more than their quota of electricity, a light bulb brighter than 40 watts, a hot plate, or a rice cooker. During one of the surprise inspections, one of the neighbors tried to hide their hot plate under a blanket and ended up with setting their apartment on fire. The mobile police often dropped in after midnight to see if there were any overnight guests who might have come to visit without travel permits. It was a serious offense, even if it was just an out-of-town relative, and much worse if the guest happened to be a lover. See how that smacks of Christianity? They control their sex lives, and sex outside of marriage is a big, big no-no and can get you sent to the gulag. Okay, but it wasn't just the police and the volunteer leagues who did the snooping. Everybody was supposed to be vigilant for subversive behavior and transgressions of the rules. Since the country was too poor and the power supply too unreliable for electronic surveillance, state security relied on human intelligence, snitches. The newspapers would occasionally run feature stories about heroic children who ratted out their parents. To be denounced by a neighbor for bad-mouthing the regime was nothing extraordinary. Chang Bo's interrogation lasted 3 days. The agents yelled and cursed at him, although they never beat him. At least that's what he told his wife. He claimed afterwards that his gift with language helped him talk his way out of the bind. He cited the truth in his defense. I wasn't insulting anybody. I was simply saying that I haven't been able to buy those boots and I'd like to have some for my family, Chang Bo protested indignantly. He made a convincing case. He was a commanding figure with his pot belly and stern expression. He looked like the epitome of a Workers' Party official. The political police in the end decided not to push the case and released him without charges. When he returned home, he got a tongue lashing from his wife that was almost harsher than the interrogation. It was the worst fight of their marriage. For Mrs. Song, it was not merely that her husband had been disrespectful of the government of the first time in her life. She felt the stirrings of fear. Her conduct had always been so impeccable and her devotion so genuine that it never occurred to her that she might be vulnerable. Why did you say such nonsense when there were neighbors in the apartment? Didn't you realize you could have jeopardized everything we have? She railed at him. In fact, they both realized how lucky they were. If not for Chang Bo's excellent class background and his party membership, he would not have been let off so lightly. It helped, too, that Mrs. Song had at various times been head of the Inimban in the building and commanded some respect from the state security officers. Chang Bo's offhand remark was precisely the kind of thing that could result in deportation to a prison camp in the mountains if the offender didn't have a solid position in the community. They heard of a man who cracked a joke about Kim Il-sung's height and was sent away for life. Propaganda campaigns advise women to adopt traditional hairstyles in accordance with the socialist way of life and the taste of epoch. For middle-aged women, that means hair cut short and permed. Unmarried women can wear their hair longer if it is tied back or braided. North Korean women are not permitted to wear skirts above the knee or sleeveless shirts. Interestingly, South Korea had similar regulations about hair and dress in the 1970s under the military dictator Park Chung-hee. It is a sign of how much North Korea remains frozen in time and how much South Korea has changed since the most radical differences between the two cultures are manifested in sexuality and dress. A few years ago, while on a trip to the pocket of North Korea that is frequented by South Korean tourists, I saw a North Korean hotel doorman look like he was on the verge of fainting at the sight of a young South Korean woman in low-cut jeans and a midriff revealing top. Many North Korean defectors I have interviewed told me the thing they found most surprising about South Korea was that couples kiss in public. This sort of Christian morality, Judeo-Christian morality, is prevalent in all communist countries. Sexuality, open sexuality, is a taboo. You do not have sex unless you have a piece of paper saying that you're married. You do not dress in ways that they do in the West here. Nudity is taboo. It's totally out. The whole thing, the Judeo-Christianity, is just prevalent over there with their way of life and everything. Old Testament morals, if you want to call them morals. I think it's just sick garbage. But this has gone on for a long, long time, and there was a book, out Sharon Osbourne, and she's Jewish, wife of Ozzy Osbourne. Ozzy Osbourne's a Gentile, but his wife's Jewish. And they went to Ozfest or something. This was towards the end of the 80s, Glasnost, when Mikhail Gorbachev was the head of the Soviet Union. And she wrote in the book, though, how dreary it was over there. I mean, it was just disgusting. They don't have, like, shopping malls like we do over here, or entertainment. I mean, it's just a slave labor state. But a lot of the Soviet teens and young people came to Ozfest for the first time they were allowed to do that. And Sharon Osbourne wrote in her book, his autobiography, she wrote two autobiographies. I have it listed in the JOS sermons. Go to sermons on the Joy of Satan and High Priestess Maxine Dietrich sermons, and that 2010 PDF, it's in there. I wrote about it, and I also cited the book and the copyright and everything, if anybody's interested. She said that there was a young girl, a young Russian girl, was in the bleachers, and she lifted up her shirt and bared her breasts. And within seconds, the KGB were on top of her. I mean, talking about a young girl. Yanked her from the stands and beat her with clubs and dragged her away. That, there is no difference. I don't care what they try to tell you if you start researching this enough. There's no difference between Christianity and communism. And these 40-watt light bulbs, they're trying to do the same thing over here. And if you look for it, you can see where there's different... They're trying to insidiously condition the American people into accepting communism, just like this Obamacare and all the rest of this garbage. And it's important to be aware of this. And Satan, spirituality, true spirituality, where you have your own spiritual power, and you are aware of your own spirituality through satanic meditation, is one way of combating these assholes. Because one of their major goals is to strip you of all spiritual power and knowledge so that you're helpless against them. And that sort of thing is kept at the top. I'm ending this sermon, and it's very important. Get the word out. Make copies of these CDs. Distribute them. Especially in countries where people don't have internet, translate this, just get the word out. We need to fight against this, because this Judeo-Christian monster is intent on taking over the world. Every day, I just want to add before closing here, American atheists, now a lot of people, I say you're better an atheist than a damn Christian, or a Muslim for that matter. I used to be an atheist. I was an atheist for over 15 years. And a lot of these people, they're so repulsed, understandably, by, you know, the Christian and Muslim programs that they turn to atheism. And that's what I did. But American atheists, there's a lot of decent people, Gentile people, but then at the top, again, they're controlled by Jews. But the ones that are decent, every single day, they are battling in the court system in the United States, just battling it out, trying to keep what little freedoms we still have that the Judeo-Christians are encroaching upon. Just pushing it and pushing it, like pushing prayer in public schools. And it's horrid. It is just horrid. I wrote about that. I live in the Bible Belt here in Oklahoma. And they don't give a damn about separation of church and state in the schools. They're just gung-ho on trying to brainwash and indoctrinate the youth into Christianity. And that's one of their sore points that I've gotten over the years. The harder the enemy attacks me, I know where to fight back. They're letting me know. Oh, and just keep it up. They're real touchy about the youth coming to Satan. They've attacked the teen group many times, and also Hell's Army group. They've shut that down several times. They just put it right back up. And we're going to keep putting things right back up, and we're going to keep pushing our side. We don't turn the other cheek. Hail Satan. It's important to, if at all possible, listen to these sermons in sequence. They're all numbered because each one builds on the other. One of the major tactics that the Jews use is in gaining control is they take control of the justice system in any area that they infest. If you look in the yellow pages of your local phone directory, look, the judges, the attorneys, especially on the attorneys section, it's very, very disproportionately Jewish. Jewish last names. I mean, those like Cohen, Levi, Levitt, just N. Goldstein. No Jewish names. And on the GBLT website, there's a listing of Know Your Enemy, and there's a list of Jewish surnames on there. And there's many more than that. They gain control of the justice system. And what they do from there, they just screw you to the wall. And if you watch their television programs and movies, injustice is actually promoted subliminally. You know, it's not hard to watch it, but even in children's cartoons, incessant injustice is just pushed. And some of the few movies that are made about Satan shows what justice is. And of course, you see the connotation there, the subliminal message there, that justice is supposed to be wrong. The Jewish court system, of course, then they call it liberalism, okay, which is a joke in itself, because you see, anything goes. Child rape and murder, violent crime, you just get a slap on the wrist, but except for a few things. If somebody's nationalistic or racially aware, they'll throw the book at you, like they did to Dr. Matt Hale. He got 40 years. He was framed just for a comment. And if that doesn't smack of communism, it was a Jewish judge that did it to him. It's horrible. Then they take you and they shoot you full of drugs. And this next sermon, too, I might divide this into two parts, seeing how long this is. How the injustice is just rampant in communist countries, and the use of punitive medicine. And as we all are aware, anybody that doesn't conform with the Jewish agenda or totally conform with the system is labeled as insane, or they have psychological problems, yadda yadda yadda. They're nuts, right? And they try to get them into counseling. That's like step one. And it's getting to where there's no, in the laws in the United States used to be that, you know, it's not compulsory medical treatment. You know, you can refuse medical treatment. Not anymore. In most cases, you have to be formally discharged from a hospital before you can leave. I've heard of different news stories, all kinds of things, accounts where a person was not allowed to leave a hospital unless they were formally signed out, unless they snuck out or something and got out somehow, and there's guards all over the place. That's one. Taken to the communist, where the communist end goal is for the Jews, they have punitive medicine. You do not have the right to refuse. And they use medicine, certain drugs, to torture people that disagree with them. So you see, anybody that's against the Jews or against their agenda or wants to stand up for their own race, especially if you're white, you're deemed as insane. And then there's compulsory treatment. All kinds of violent crimes are just let off the hook, and in many cases the victim is the one that's prosecuted here in the United States. As I said, they're just screwing the justice system to the wall, and this has been going on for a very long period of time. Same thing with Jewish psychology and these stupid dumb fucks that I'd like to slash from ear to ear, I hate them so bad, that say, oh, well, life is what you make it. That's very typical. And I mean that figuratively, but I'm telling you, I mean they need to really be smacked upside the head. Life is not what you make it. In some cases, okay, like as opposed to someone who's trying and someone who isn't. But would you tell that to a 5-year-old child dying of brain cancer? And how many times do they blame the victim? They're always blaming the victim for problems that the victim had nothing to do with creating, but the system does. And then there's people that other idiots, total idiots, seen on the television. Well, just do what you're told to do. You can only do that for so long, to where the Jew, the Jewish demands upon you are so great, where debt is concerned, you owe, you owe, you owe. And that's the general theme of the Judeo-Christian Bible. You owe, you owe, you owe. You are born into original sin. You must be sorry. Everybody must be sorry, and you have to pay. So it already plants a seed, a subliminal seed in everyone's mind that they're indebted, and they have to be sorry, and they have to pay. And these quotas that the Jews demand from their workers, their disposable human beings, gets to be so great that they can no longer pay, and then they just wind up dead, living under Jewish communism. It's just like in the Ukraine. I mentioned that I had shirt-tail relations in the Ukraine, and my family was talking about it a long time ago when I was a kid. And they said that there was a family that was related to us over there in the Ukraine. And they demanded so much rent and, they took total control of their property, which was originally theirs, their taxes, their rent, and their crop, and they couldn't cover it. And this was like one of millions over there. And the family over here at that time in the 1930s sent them some money through the mail to try to cover it, took up a collection for them. Well, the NKVD, Russian secret police over there, Soviet secret police, intercepted it. And with a very short period of time, the family was rounded up and they were sent to Siberia. And the mother of the family died eating grass. And they were all dead. And that's the way it is. And I'm going to be reading this is quite long, and I might break this up into two parts here, depending on how long it is. I don't want to keep it too long. There is a Soviet miner named Alexander Nikitin, and he spoke, this is again the book Russia and the Russians Inside the Close Society by Kevin Close, and he spoke with Kevin Close, who, as I went through before, worked for the Washington Post in Moscow. He was an American citizen, Kevin Close, and a Harvard graduate. And Alexander Nikitin spoke with Kevin Close, and Kevin Close wrote about what happened to this man who tried to stand up for justice in the Soviet Union. And this is where all this is going. And as I mentioned many, many times, the Judeo-Christian Bible is a preparation for Jewish communism, and to accept Jewish communism and just total slavery. Don't live your life for this life, or fight back, live for your death. And you're supposed to be rewarded all these goodies in heaven and stuff if you just, you know, keep your mouth shut and be a total perfect slave. I don't think so. As many of us know, you're just damned into it. And about this counseling industry and everything, they've got everybody strung out on drugs now. So you see the Prozac, all kinds of things, that they create the problem. And then they push a solution. So many kids are just drugged up. Most people are dependent on drugs in one way or another. And when they pull the rug out to where those drugs aren't available, there's going to be a big, big problem. Antidepressants, for one, from what I understand, is if a person stops taking them, they can wind up, it's like a backlash in the brain or something like that, because it stops certain chemicals in the brain. And then they go rampant if the person stops the antidepressant suddenly. And it just, they go into a deep depression, and many commit suicide. And that's what the Jew wants. And it also has to do with industrial farming and how depressed the animals are. It's horrific. This article is long, and I had to break it up. This is about Alexander Nikitin. As an activist agitator in the Butovka trade union, he began hearing complaints about miners cheated of bonuses or transferred to menial jobs because they spoke out. Several men were dismissed for the same violations of labor discipline that others had been forgiven. Alexei began working to get these men reinstated. When he succeeded, he began to hear of even more abuses. As he gained experience, his views matured, and he began to realize that the closed party meetings where these matters were discussed were farcical at best and malign at worst. He felt that his mentor, Serachev, was a principled man, but whenever some serious problem of wage cheating or repressive actions by the mine chiefs was brought up, Serachev deflected the matter with a joke or an anecdote that throttled serious talk. He seemed to play the role of a deliberate court jester. Most of the time, the party sessions dealt with mind-numbing and utterly irrelevant twists and turns of the party's international policies or the decisions of whatever recent party congress was still thought to be important. Nikitin concluded that every major question had been decided in advance by the Butovka chiefs. They had no interest in seeing their judgments challenged by rank-and-file party men or self-righteous activists like Alexei. The Butovka mine director was Viktor Filipovich Savich, and I also want to mention Savich is a Jewish name, who had been married into the family of the Donetsk Oblast party chief, Vladimir Dekaterev. Savich was openly known as the Prince of Butovka. Dekaterev was called the Tsar of the region. In coordination with his regional peers, this man ruled several million subjects with absolute authority, and he inspired fear and awe in his fiefdom. Nikitin himself had once chanced to hear Dekaterev make a speech at another mine. Alexei came away with the experience with the strong feeling that the party chieftain was a cultured, ruthless, and capable leader. Within a few years, Nikitin would find himself in direct confrontation with this man. Dekaterev spent most of his life in the shafts and tunnels of the party in the Ukraine. He was an engineer, a mover, a shaker, and a survivor. He lived through the terror, and any man who achieved that lived afterwards with the knowledge that Moscow could strike without warning or provocation. The 1930s had decimated the Ukrainian party, as one survivor of that time recalled us in an interview in Moscow. At the Donetsk Steelworkers alone, this source once told us, the purge cut down all but a handful of the more than 200 engineers needed to run the factory. They just disappeared, and it was never clear whether they were shot. None of us could sleep at night. No one criticized anything. We didn't trust anyone. In the aftermath of the purges and the war, Dekaterev moved up in the party and began living like a provincial nobility. As Nikitin was to find out, this mighty leader was not interested in miners' complaints. Throughout the second half of the 1960s, Nikitin reckoned later in conversations with us that he had helped restore 19 miners to jobs from which they had been illegally or unfairly fired. He had a reputation as a person who cared, and years later, when we walked with him on the streets of Donetsk, I was astonished to see other miners, braving the secret police lurking behind us, walk up to Alexei, shake his hand warmly, or clap him on the back and offer a few words of encouragement. It seemed to him that under the corrosive leadership of Savich, safety conditions at Butovka were deteriorating. His job repairing and installing electrical equipment took him all over the mine and its tunnels. He was appalled to see the sloppy way explosives were stored below, the dangers of improperly maintained equipment, and the general disregard for safety precautions. The chiefs made clear that they cared about only one thing, beating the quota. Nothing else counted. Alexei began raising the question of safety at the closed party meetings. Each time his questions were deflected in the usual way. He couldn't stand the boss's smugness any longer. He took a fateful step further. He complained to the Oblast Party Committee. Within days, he was called in and told he was not qualified to judge safety matters and he'd be smart to keep his ignorant mouth shut. Nikitin's conception of what his country wanted from its people changed. He began reflecting on the string of solemn promises from the succession of Soviet leaders, including the great Lenin himself, of a better life to come. His party history books could tell him that on the 22nd of March 1919, the party had adopted a program of Lenin's promising an 8-hour day, a month's vacation, and free medicine and medical help for pregnant women and other classes of workers. There would be safety inspections of the workplace, and the state truly would defend the worker. But so far as he knew, even the promise of an 8-hour day was something of a myth, since there was so much extra work to be done to reach plan norms. The rest of the promises of 1919 had never been met. Lenin had decreed trade unions should function as transmission belts from the party to the people, guaranteeing that the real power would remain with the party. The concept embodied in this assured that the party defended its power and not the people. Trade unions had no power in such a system and were utterly subservient to the party in any clash of interests. Khrushchev's program at the beginning of the decade had promised a 35-hour work week, free food at the workplace, free medicine, free housing, and free transportation to most places. Not one promise had been fulfilled, and it was considered offensive to raise the former leader's name in party meetings. Nikitin was losing his face. And then 20 Butovka miners came to him complaining that they had been cheated out of a bonus promised if they fulfilled the plan that month. Nikitin listened, and he knew that what the men demanded should be given to them. He suggested they organize a delegation to raise a complaint with the directorate. Anything less than a delegation would be ignored. At the same time, it seemed unlikely that there could be a reprisal since the group was so large. The miners waited for a retort from the Central Committee. From Moscow came only silence. And then one day in early 1970, Nikitin was called into the local party committee where he was denounced and expelled for unsatisfactory performance. Some days later, the scene was repeated. He was fired from his job at Butovka. A dorm slammed shut on his life, and he was never able to open it again. Meanwhile, the state lost no time in rooting out the dangerous dissatisfaction that Nikitin's petition represented. Each miner who had signed the offending document was called into the mine directorate, denounced, and threatened with punishment if he did not repudiate it. While a city committee apparatchik bureaucrat looked on, a number of miners grudgingly wrote out renunciations and signed them. But many others refused and were summarily transferred to other mines. The authorities feared so large a group of disgruntled workers in one place. If he was shocked or chastened by his harsh treatment, Nikitin gave no sign. His hardy constitution took the blows. "I am a Russian and I was raised in a patriotic family," he mused later. "Like all Russians, I deeply love my people, our land, our folk songs, but I began to believe that to live in this country is impossible. Unlimited terror by the authorities without any law. This happened because I started to defend workers without the boss's permission." Alexei took up his own cause with the same energy he had devoted to his colleagues. He began petitioning every level of the Donetsk hierarchy with letters, visits, and telephone calls. He burrowed into the maze of bureaucrats, ferreted out secretaries and nachalniki, and spent hours waiting for a few moments' confrontation with the party men. In every case, his complaint was bucked somewhere else, but he persisted. At last, he was permitted to present his case to the local party control commission, which was charged with abdicating disciplinary matters. The commission was headed by the city party chief himself, A.A. Kubushkin. Aside from having little inclination to find fault with his own underlings, Kubushkin was a crony of Dekhterev's. His review board exhibited the same seamless face of power as the Butovka mine directorate itself. Commission members included senior factory and mine workers, senior party officials, senior representatives of police and the KGB. Nevertheless, Nikitin pressed for a hearing. Some 70 officials were on hand when the case was heard. When Nikitin sat before this segment of the local leadership, a pensioner droned through the tale of Alexei's expulsion. The attention of the listeners focused with ferocious intensity on the petitioner, the old man who had barely finished when Pabushkin raged the attack. "So you defend the people, do you?" he screamed at Alexei. "Well, you're a literate fellow. You've read your history. In the history books, it's written that those who tried to lead the masses, they lost their heads." A heavy silence fell, but Nikitin was not intimidated. "I grew up amid the people, and if defending them means losing my head, I'm ready." At this, Kubushkin began screaming for the police chief. "Voronov, open a case against him." Nikitin stalked out. Within days, agents began shadowing him. Ostentatiously, they took his photograph on the street and from time to time showed up at the apartment to question him about various city crimes. Oblast Party Chief Degetyarev reviewed the case and the regional SAR told Alexei, "If you stick your nose into our business, I'll mix coal with your blood and take your body and grind you into fertilizer." With the pressure all around him, Alexei found his personal life crumbling. When former mine colleagues came to chew the fat, bringing vodka or homemade hooch like the old times, he was suspicious, fearing that these friends had brought under KGB control and that he risked arrest on a drunk charge. He sipped his liquor slowly and kept his counsel. He earned small amounts of money from odd jobs in the city and countryside. Part of the time, he returned to Bryansk Oblast, where he had been born. It was just as impoverished as he remembered as a child, but he found work on state and collective farms where sloth and drunkenness appalled him. The Oblast was exploited by the production system. He was outraged to find, for example, that while the farms in the area raised wheat that had been shipped off and ground into flour for refined white bread for the rest of the country, the farmers themselves had only brown bread to gnaw on. They never got the white flour back, he remembered. The Lenin Collective Farm now was run by Nikolai Gapanov, a pirate. In the late 1970s, Alexei said shortages were embedded in Bryansk life. State local stores lacked cereal, meat, noodles, macaroni, paper supplies, and milk. Bread supplies were poor, and if it rained, there might be no bread for several days because of delivery problems. There were never any sweet buns and no white bread, only brown bread. Over the next 2 years, he would spend months in Moscow, living the strange life of a truth seeker, a historic calling in Russia. Truth seekers were as much a part of the country's ritual and tradition as the icon. The existence of an unkempt and stubborn petitioner in the faceless, intimidating reception halls and corridors of government buildings implied that wrongs could be corrected and the individual had personal rights the government was interested in protecting. Thousands of truth seekers had thronged the Tsar's St. Petersburg, and thousands congregated in Moscow during the Brezhnev era. With his documents in his valise, Nikitin trudged the streets of the capital looking for justice. He found himself shunted from the Central Committee of the headquarters of all union trade organizations to the state procurator, then on to the National Parliament, the Supreme Soviet, and then to the Supreme Court and back again. Everywhere, there were lines of shuffling, unhappy citizens, ready to mumble their tales of woe to anyone listening, willing to listen. These regional folk peopled the gloomy, echoing granite halls of certain government and party buildings. The petitioners were never allowed to be comfortable. Grim-faced policemen in gray uniforms, plainclothes men, and civilian guards, the Druzhbinsky, kept vigil over the petitioners. Nikitin learned from veteran truth seekers, men and women who had spent years searching for vindication, that microphones overheard conversations in some reception halls and that a petitioner, careless with his anger, could find himself hauled out of line and sent off to a mental hospital for involuntary observation. A stay in a psychiatric hospital could mean plenty of trouble from local authorities when the pensioner got home. Regardless of which line or what institution, the routine was the same. The petitioner was made to fill out fresh forms for each visit, a painstaking process that took on nightmarish qualities as he or she worked through the meaningless series of questions and answers. The forms were good for a short time and then had to be filled out anew. Only certain officials were empowered to handle certain kinds of complaints, and if the examiner happened to be away from his desk or office, often the case, no one else could handle the petition. Sometimes a supplicant could wait for days or even weeks for the right bureaucrat to appear. Finally, the official would review the documents, listen with an utterly indifferent expression as the petitioner elaborated, and then hand out the decision. Settle this in the local organization. On April 15, 1971, Nikitin walked into the Embassy of Norway at No. 7 Voroshilovo Ulitsa in the heart of Moscow and asked to see a diplomat. It was an extraordinary stroke of luck and an example of his cunning that he had not been intercepted on the street by the uniformed KGB police who patrol every foreign chancery, compound, and residence to prevent Soviets from free access to outsiders regardless of their acceptability. The KGB guards at the East German embassy perform the same function as their colleagues outside the American embassy. That paranoia, reinforced by xenophobic state propaganda, made Nikitin's appearance at the Norwegian embassy even more remarkable. For of all the potential foreign enemies surrounding the motherland, the NATO countries are portrayed as the most threatening. Indeed, as Alexei told us, He was specifically chosen the Norwegians because of all the warnings of their perfidy he had received during his military service. If any foreigners would be interested in helping him against Soviet power, he reasoned, it would be these people. A young diplomat appeared and listened while Alexei explained his predicament and asked for assistance in sending some documents to the United States, the United Nations, and several international labor organizations. The Soviet postal system would never let them out of the country. Quite to the contrary, Nikitin knew the mailmen would make sure that he was arrested. The Norwegian refused. Then he suddenly shut the door to the interview room, cutting off the prying eyes of Soviet clerks who were employed by every foreign chancery and who reported whatever they could glean of interest to the KGB. The Norwegian accepted the petitions and gave his visitor the telephone number of the American embassy. A few months later, Nikitin was back on the sidewalk and away before the guards realized what had happened. He would never be so lucky again. Alexei phoned the Americans and spoke with a man there about visiting the chancery located on the Tchaikovskogo section of the Central Ring Road a few blocks from the Foreign Ministry. Next to the hated Red Chinese in their massive compound near Moscow State University, the U.S. Embassy was the most heavily guarded legation in the city. There were uniformed KGB police at each of the three entrances to the aging yellow stucco building, and an unmarked Volga sedan was parked nearby, ready to add agents should any Russian be foolhardy enough to attempt to get into the building without an official invitation supplied ahead of time by the Americans or a consular officer as escort and witness if the police attempted to stop the Russian guest. A small wooden guardhouse stood around the corner on the side street. The Americans accurately called it the beat-up shack. The American diplomat agreed to send Alexei an official entrance permit, which would help him get in past the guards. At Nikitin's request, the form was sent to the Central City Post Office on Gorky Street to protect the Moscow relatives Alexei was staying with from a police visit. On April 17th, Alexei went to the post office and was told that a package, but no letter, awaited him. Apprehensive, he replied that the parcel couldn't be for him and walked out. 2 days later, he returned, and this time the clerk said that there was neither a letter nor package. When Alexei left, two men darted out of the daytime crowds on Moscow's busiest shopping street and forced him into a waiting car. He spent 2 weeks at a community psychiatric hospital in Moscow. The experience left little impression on him. There was no treatment. They did it to frighten me, he told us. He wasn't frightened, and those 2 weeks ahead were so innocuous that they offered no foretaste of what lay ahead. This is getting too long. I'm going to pick this up on part two of this sermon. And this is where the United States is going if somebody doesn't try to stop this. And this is very serious. Hail Satan. I'm picking up this part two of the sermon, Christianity and Communism, Screwing Justice to the Wall. And you have to listen to part one to understand where I'm at in part two. And this is important. This article is very important that I'm reading here because they're trying to do the same thing in the United States. People aren't aware of it. They can't see what's going on around them because most people don't know what to look for, and the majority of the population is indoctrinated with lies. Okay. When he was released, the police put Alexei on a train to Donetsk with instructions to stay there. He ignored them and toward the end of 1971 returned to Moscow with new petitions to be sent abroad. Again, he made contact with the Americans and successfully passed the material on to them. Among the items was a written renunciation of Soviet citizenship. Then he returned to Donetsk, comforted by the knowledge that somewhere in the world beyond Soviet boundaries it could be learned how he had been dismissed from work in violation of his own nation's laws. On December 22, 1971, Nikitin's life changed forever. Early that morning, the safety violations he had first warned about more than 2 years earlier caught up with the bosses of the Butovka mine. Around 6 a.m., with the night shift of miners just emerged from the tunnels at the Butovka and the day shift preparing to descend into the pit, the Butovka Donetsk coal mine blew up. The explosion ripped through the underground galleries and thundered aloft over the pit head. Emergency vehicles and hysterical families raced to the shaft. Amid the pandemonium, rescue teams descended and slowly penetrated the web of tunnels, bringing up survivors and counting the victims. 7 miners were killed and more than 100 injured. Everyone knew the toll would have been much higher if the shifts had not been changing. With the families had come the KGB, carloads of agents to control the milling throng of frightened and angry miners and their families. As the death toll rose, so did the workers' fury. They began shouting, "Nikitin warned you." The KGB ringed the territory and commanded the workers to disperse. An earlier uprising in Novocherkassk was well known to many Soviet workers. During that episode in 1962, textile workers in a southern Russian city of that name rose up over the poor food and poor pay, seized party headquarters in the town, and demanded talks. Khrushchev ordered in the troops, and in the then ensuing face-off and soldiers fired on their countrymen. There had been many deaths and many wounded. Now the angry Butovka miners slowly went home. A day or two later, miners going by bus to the cemetery for the burial of one of their victims found themselves under surveillance by KGB men. Resentment flared. One of the miners burst out, "You fired Nikitin for warning about an explosion." The Chekisti leaped on the man and tossed him off the bus. When Alexei heard this tale, he figured his own days might be numbered. His problem worsened when some of his old friends began coming to see him at home to complain about the negligence at Butovka and the indifference of the Nachitniki. He was sure authorities would not allow him to remain free as a living reproof of the Butovka Directorate. He began moving from house to house, living in Donetsk on the run from the organs. It didn't last long. The KGB seized Alexei on January 13, 1972 and jailed him. He was charged with violating Article 187 of the Ukrainian Criminal Code, dissemination of knowingly false fabrications discrediting the Soviet political and social system. Penalty, 3 years at hard labor. Alexei was held incommunicado for 5 months. He had almost no contact with his brothers and sisters and never had access to a lawyer or any other person who might be able to help him defend himself. This was in accordance with Soviet criminal law, which presumes a person guilty. He had almost no contact with the police either. He seemed to have been forgotten. But on June 19th, the man who had once only wanted to right a wrong was hustled out of the city jail and herded aboard a prisoner's train with other inmates. They were locked into a passenger car that had frosted windows, and the train rolled out of the terminal. Toward the end of the day, the train stopped at a siding in the Ukrainian countryside. A flock of police vans stood nearby. The prisoners were loaded into the trucks, and the journey resumed. When they finally climbed out, they found themselves in the main jail of the city of Dnepropetrovsk. I'm sorry, I can't pronounce some of these words. I'm just reading as I go along. Ekaterinoslav Dnepropetrovsk has two more modern distinctions. In 1938, Khrushchev, who was then in power of the Ukraine, sent a bushy-browed young-comer named Leonid Brezhnev to the city to assume command of the local party in the aftermath of the savage purge of the Ukrainian party. Brezhnev did well, taking one more step upward in the long climb to power that culminated in his ouster of Khrushchev from supreme leadership 26 years later. The final distinction is this. On maps of the Soviet Union that the Foreign Ministry sometimes hands out to foreign travelers, the city appears circled in red. This signifies it to be close to foreigners. Its close status made Dnepropetrovsk ideal for certain state functions that demanded a special measure of secrecy. In 1968, the Ministry of Internal Affairs, the MVD, opened a facility which Nikitin and most other Soviets had no idea existed. Now Alexei was taken from the city's main jail to this clandestine place. He found himself inside a double-walled fortress surmounted by watchtowers manned by uniformed guards carrying automatic weapons. This strange and forbidding prison was called the Dnepropetrovsk Special Psychiatric Hospital for the Criminally Insane. It was June 20, 1972, barely a month earlier, responding to the yearnings of millions for a more peaceful, just world. President Richard M. Nixon had arrived in Moscow for his first and most successful summit with the apparatchik from Dnepropetrovsk, Leonid Brezhnev. The age of detente was about to begin. The White Guard garbed criminals who functioned as orderlies at the cycle prison stripped Nikitin naked. Methodically, they listed each article of his clothing and put it aside for storage. Perhaps this meant he would be released soon, since they must be saving the clothing for a reason. But they said, "Now, dear comrade, you're going to be here for life." "How do you know for life?" "Little friend, they've decided you're a fool and you've got a political offense, so don't worry about your clothing. You're here for life." He was sent to disinfecting baths in the basement, then brought back and dressed in black prison trousers and a felon's loose-fitting striped shirt. Then he was escorted through the grim corridors by an orderly who confided that Nikitin was about to be given a pill, and he'd be smart to take it without complaint or resistance. Otherwise, they would force it down his throat. They arrived at the dispensary room, where other orderlies attended to a line of inmates. A middle-aged medical sister thrust a cup of water and a pill at him. "I'm a healthy man, and I won't take any medicine that I don't need." They explained his situation to him this way: "You were brought here forcibly, and you will be treated forcibly if you refuse to cooperate. If you don't want to take this pill, you will be bound and then injected with it." He saw that they were dead serious. Even though they wore white hospital smocks that gave them the look of hospital personnel, they themselves were prisoners, criminals who would have no compunction about beating him if they wanted to. He would take the medicine and hope that nothing worse would befall him. He washed the pill down. It was a Majeptil, a powerful tranquilizer that had triggered suicides in other psycho prisons when inmates were overdosed with it. The shock was enormous, so much that when I stood up, I was off balance and the world was spinning around me. It was hard to move. I felt hot burning, subdued. Nikitin was marched through the prison and deposited in front of a heavy wooden door. An orderly unlocked it and swung it open. It was a nightmare that no one should ever see. Dim light from windows high up in the walls filtered weakly into a room about 20 by 30 feet in area. So many dormitory-style iron-frame beds jammed the floor that there was hardly any room to move. Yet strange creatures were in motion beneath a high ceiling where caged lights burned feebly day and night. The faces that turned towards Nikitin were a faded yellow from endless days out of reach of the sun. They had a wan, pasty look from lack of exercise and a starchy diet. Some of the faces were contorted into frightening masks, with the features bunched to one side or the other, brows pulled close, eyes staring or flitting at high speed from point to point. Some of the inmates had fragile frames, made even weaker from years of inactivity. Some chewed their tongues, drooled through slack jaws, or made licking and swallowing motions. Some stood hunched and swaying, hands moving spasmodically, fingers curling or rolling imaginary ball bearings or other objects across their palms. There were murmurs, sobs, groans, sighs, and here and there snatches of furtively spoken words. Some men lay on their stomachs on their beds and could not turn over. Others seemed possessed by devilishly spirits that caused them to roll and turn incessantly or pace back and forth like crazed animals, while some lay in dazed stupors, inert and uncaring. A heavy, musky odor laced with the sharp smell of urine and the stench of vomit and excrement permeated the air. From time to time, someone crept forward to implore the orderly at the door to let the prisoners out to relieve themselves in foul-smelling toilets elsewhere in the prison. If they were denied, the men soiled themselves in the ward. Men coughed and hacked up phlegm and spat it on the floor, and men in the grips of drug treatment vomited. Others ignored these commonplace calamities. Many pairs of eyes pried at Nikitin. With the stocky man with the roughened hands of a workman and the dazed look of a newcomer, a murderer, rapist, homosexual, religious believer, he could be any of these things, for the ward contained every kind of transgressor of socialist order, and there were many wards in the Dnepropetrovsk Citadel. The door closed behind him. Soon Alexei was put in the hands of two physicians who led the examination of what they called his case. Captain Nikolai Karpovich Alexeyev ran the sessions, assisted by Victoria V. Blokhina, a psychiatric professor whose husband was a KGB colonel. Alexeyev was a senior captain in the Uniform National Police run by the Ministry of Internal Affairs, the MVD. It was a peculiarity of Soviet public health policies that its hospitals for the criminally insane were run by the MVD, which together with the KGB functioned as a successor to the dread NKVD, which had run Stalin's terror and his concentration camps. It is not possible to know what was asked or how the physicians went about determining Alexei's health, but the universe within the closely guarded walls of Dnipropetrovsk was an unusual one when measured against most Western psychiatric traditions. It had been shaped largely by the theories of Ivan Pavlov, the world-famed behavioralist who early in the century had gained insights into human behavior by closely studying dogs. His best-known theory was that of the conditioned response, in which he demonstrated that with the proper combination of punishment and reward, dogs could be trained to salivate when they heard a bell, a signal previously associated with the sight of food. They would water at the mouth whether or not the food came. The notion of conditioned reflex had unique appeal for a totalitarian state that permitted only one ideology. During the next three decades, the concept of who was mentally ill and what kind of behavior constituted derangement came more and more to reflect communist ideology, which emphasizes the needs and the goals of the collective ahead of the individual. Since the party was inseparable from nationhood and a well-adjusted Soviet citizen was loyal to the motherland, it followed that it was disloyal to question the party. In practical terms, a person who could not submit to the dictates of the local party committee, trade union, farm management, factory, or mine directorate could be more than a troublesome nonconformist or disloyal. Within the framework of the Soviet insistence upon conformity, it was apparent that those who rejected conformity, the norm of the community, in some cases might be deranged. Conformity had a special role in the Russian psyche anyway. As these powers expanded, the system of psychoprisons also grew. In the post-Stalin years, there may have been no more than half a dozen special psychiatric hospitals, or SPHs. By the late 1970s, it was believed in the West that there were about two dozen of these hospitals in operation, all of them under the control of the MVD. Other countries might find it at least odd that the care and treatment of criminally insane citizens would be entrusted to the mercies of the national police. In the USSR, such thoughts were disloyal. Thus it wasn't that Nikitin found his doctors wearing police uniforms under their white surgical smocks, an oddity which made clear for him that the only reason anyone wore white at Dnipropetrovsk was to make it look like a hospital. During sessions with his doctors, Alexei never learned that under Soviet law he was entitled to the services of a medical commission to review his incarceration, and that law gave him the right to name a physician of his own choice to the group. Alexei learned that as a patient, he would be allowed only minimal contact with his family, including the equivalent of two postcards a month, that he was forbidden to write any Soviet official, and that he would have nominal library privileges. The place was organized like a prison and not a hospital at all. The bars on the windows of the wards, corridors, treatment bays, and eating halls were no accident. After 2 weeks of sessions with Alexeyev and Blokhina, Alexei was diagnosed as deranged, suffering from psychopathology, simple form. Treatment unspecified, length of incarceration indefinite. The psychoprison was a strange and lawless place. The most dangerous of all the denizens seemed to be the MBD doctors and nurses who ran the SPH and who believed that punishment with drugs was the most effective remedy for deranged behavior. The doctors' eyes and ears in the crowded wards were the orderlies, criminals who had the authorities' trust. From the time of Stalin's prisons, Soviet jails used common criminals to help run the penal system. The orderlies were thieves, muggers, and rapists, and they hunted ceaselessly for excuses to beat patients. They bullied and insulted in hopes of finding a hint of resistance from an inmate. A sudden move of the hand, an unguarded laugh, a sigh, or even a cry of despair or pain could bring on the orderlies. Whatever precautions the inmates might take, the predators always found prey. Then two or three well-fed criminal orderlies would pounce on an enfeebled, drug-ridden patient and spread-eagle him in a crucifix as they dragged him into a punishment cell, pummeling his kidneys and stomach. They would trust the unconscious victim to a bedstead where he might be left for days defecating on himself and trying to feed himself with hands tied to the bed. Sometimes the prisoner was thrown into solitary confinement, a tiny, unheated cell with a steel pipe bed frame without mattress or blankets. This was called the wall treatment and could go on for years. Sometimes the offending patient would be disciplined with a wet pack or roll-up wrapped like a mummy in a wet canvas strips that shrank as they dried, grinding the body like some medieval torturer's machine, compression the joints. The victim shrieked with pain, but mostly the doctors and nurses came running with their syringes and vials, eager to inject a punishment dose of sulfazine, a form of sulfur suspended in peach oil. Of all the many drugs administered at Dnipropetrovsk to impose discipline, sulfazine stood at the pinnacle of pain. Originally used more than 50 years earlier to treat malaria by inducing a high fever, giving sulfazine its oddly sinister classification as a pyrogenic, the concoction had been used intermittently in European and American mental hospitals in the 1920s and 1930s to treat some kinds of extreme and chronic schizophrenia. Despite its bizarre power to subdue even a violent person by inducing high fever, nausea, mental disorientation, and severe muscle spasms, most Western psychiatrists found that sulfazine had no therapeutic value and discontinued its use. These were the qualities that made it so attractive to the MVD doctors at Dnipropetrovsk. People injected with sulfazine were groaning, sighing with pain, cursing the psychiatrists and the Soviet power, cursing with everything in their hearts, Alexei told us. People go into horrible convulsions and get completely disoriented. Their body temperature rises to 40 degrees centigrade almost instantly, and the pain is so intense they cannot move from their beds for 3 days. Sulfazine is a simple way to destroy a man completely. If they torture you and break your arms, there is a certain specific pain and you can somehow stand it. But sulfazine is like a drill boring into your body that gets worse and worse until it's more than you can stand. It's impossible to endure. It is worse than torture because sometimes torture may end, but this kind of torture may continue for years. Sulfazine normally was prescribed in a course of injections of increasing strength over a period that might last up to 2 months. The mixture caused a violent long-term reaction in the muscles at the site of the injection, normally the buttocks. Within hours after the first shot, the pain was so excruciating that a victim could not sit down and was forced to lie on his stomach to sleep. He could not lift his legs, which meant that some men were trapped by the maze of the bed frames in Nikitin's ward, unable to propel themselves to toilet or dining room. They languished in misery, dependent upon the whims of the orderlies or the compassion of other inmates for food and companionship. The stench from their suffering hung in the air. There were baths once a week in the spring, summer, and fall, and in the winter a bath every 10 days, Alexei said. The water was frigid and no one wanted to go to bathe, but they were sweaty from the effects of the medicine and the place stank with sickness. Behaviorist Ivan Pavlov had staunchly maintained that mental illness was a consequence of chemical imbalance in the brain and nervous system best treated by chemicals. So there was an inclination towards drugs within Soviet psychiatry that was reflected in everyday life at Dnipropetrovsk. The doctors had many other drugs with which to control and punish. Most of them eventually were used on Alexei. Aminazine is a powerful tranquilizer, equivalent to Thorazine in the West and used freely for severe schizophrenia. It causes depression, weight loss, low blood pressure, skin pigmentation changes, and sensory distortions that could last for months after use. Haloperidol, another tranquilizer, was used very widely at Dnipropetrovsk and seems to have been the principal cause of the pill-rolling motor distortions. Alexei saw when he first entered the ward. Haloperidol, when used alone, causes severe disruptions in muscle control that will bring on head rolling, swallowing, stammering, lip licking, convulsions, and other Parkinsonian-like side effects. To avoid these unpleasant accompaniments, the Soviet doctors needed to use other drugs to consort with the haloperidol. At Dnipropetrovsk, this was never done. Other drugs in the pharmacopoeia included Sanipax, triftazine, and tizepin. Each had its specific pain, but the drug of choice remained sulfazine. Shortly after he was diagnosed, Nikitin was called into Dr. Victoria Blokhina's office. She looked at him and announced, "We'll do this," she prescribed, "a course of one needle of sulfazine a week for the next 2 months." Every part of me was sick. They did this without any reason. There were horrible days. At the end of the 2 months, Nikitin was taken off sulfazine, but regular doses of haloperidol and other disorientating drugs continued the entire time he was imprisoned. Because they took exceptional care not to cross the order, Nikitin came to believe that most Dnepropetrovsk patients were not demented. Their behavior made clear that they recognized danger and how to avoid it. After months of watching and surreptitious conversations, he concluded that perhaps as few as 15% of all the inmates were insane. Even the worst of the killers seemed perfectly healthy psychologically, he said. The killers supported me. We were all in the same situation. They knew they were guinea pigs. There were killers in there, but most of them were inside because of the need for experiments like rabbits, he said. We know our lives are simply going to be a slow death. They had given up any hope of ever leaving the psycho prison. After they had been punished with sulfazine, the murderers writhed in their beds moaning for a Kalashnikov, assault rifle, a balalaika, and I'll settle with them for good. But no one allowed them to settle anything. The doctors controlled them by needles. The inhabitants of the prison were extraordinarily diverse. There were nationalists, religious believers, anti-Soviet agitators, complainers, uncompromising truth seekers, and even some men who had tried to escape their motherland by walking across her tightly guarded borders. There was Vasily Seri in his mid-40s, a geography teacher from Odessa who had hijacked a plane and had been sent back to Soviet territory. He was lucky he hadn't been executed, he told Alexei. He had been through three court hearings, and at last they sent him to Dnepropetrovsk as punishment. His wife moved to the city to be near him, and though he could never hope to be freed, she saw him once a week. It was something to live for. Komsomol member, arrested as a spy for Yaroslav M. Stolar, a 26-year-old former Komsomol member, arrested as a spy for collecting information on military matters. He said he had copied the information from his own military unit. He had once been a regular journalist with a blemish-free record of service to the country. Alexei thought that perhaps he was being punished because he had relatives living in West Germany. Nikolai Valkov was a Ukrainian nationalist arrested for publishing an underground journal that opposed Soviet power in the Ukraine. Valkov had company. Viktor Perfentievich Rafalevsky, a school director from the southern Ukraine, also a staunch nationalist, and a man named Boris, who had designed a flag for an independent Ukraine and had been arrested as a reactionary nationalist after one display of it. Mark Stioba had a remarkable tale to tell. He had escaped from the Ukraine during the war and managed to make his way to Australia, where he married, settled down, and fathered two children. But his disease left him impotent, he said, and he relayed this unfortunate fact to his sister, who stayed behind in the Ukraine. Soon she wrote back that the Soviets had recently perfected a foolproof cure. He applied for a visa and quickly received one. When he set foot in the soil of the motherland, the KGB arrested him as a traitor. Eventually he wound up in Dnepropetrovsk. There was a man named Lukanov who had collaborated with the Nazis and then escaped and built a new life in the West. But years later, he yearned to show his children his homeland. When he entered Soviet territory with a valid Soviet visa, he was arrested and sent to Dnepropetrovsk. There are many others as well, but perhaps the one who stood out most sharply in Alexei's memory was Pyotr Morivov. Many years before, Morivov had written angry letters to Nikita Khrushchev denouncing him as an illiterate peasant who was unfit to be chief of state. Morivov was arrested in 1957, Alexei said. He spent 20 years in prisons and hospitals for reaching the same conclusion about Khrushchev in 1957 that the Politburo itself reached in 1964. The story goes on, and it's quite lengthy, and it's really, really sad. He got out of there, got out of that mental hospital, and they arrested him and put him right back in there again. And he spent like 8 out of 10 years confined in a Soviet psychiatric hospital and what they call punitive medicine. And in his later years, because of the drugs that they forcibly injected him with to torture him with, he lost his eyesight and went blind. And that's all too common in what happens in these communist countries. Disposable human beings, there's no justice. it's just horrific. And they're trying to do that here. If you look for the telltale signs, most of this, like I mentioned before, I'm reading this. Satan wanted me to read this. He's been most insistent upon it of late. And this isn't taught in the schools over here. It's just like the Siberian concentration camps, like different places. Everybody knows Auschwitz, Treblinka, and all that garbage that never happened the way they said it did. They said, you know, they're all liars. You look up Holocaust denial and videos and that, and they don't have anything to stand on. It's just garbage. They lie, the Jews do. But these are the real concentration camps, and the way people are treated, and it's just as bad in China, the Falun Gong practitioners and different peoples, and I'll be doing more sermons on that. And we need to fight against this. If you don't fight for freedom, freedom is something that's fought for and hard won. If we don't start fighting now, waking up to this Christian, communist, Jewish program, all of us are going to wind up dead.
There's a blue flashing light. Someone's in trouble, some bad night. A flickering neon stands ready to view. The wind blows away all of yesterday's news. Well, they've locked up their daughters and they've battened the hatches. They always could find us, but they never could catch us. Through the grease-streaked window of an all-night cafe, we watch the arrested get taken away, and that cigarette haze is a college beat, as the horse and the drums falling from the street.